Isabel Allende is arguably the world's most famous Latina author. Born in Peru, she was raised in Chile, from where she, her then husband and two children fled in 1975 after the coup which overthrew the government led by her father's cousin Salvador Allende. She worked as a journalist in Venezuela and then California. She was 40 when her first novel, The House of the Spirits, became an immediate success. Her 25th book, The Soul of a Woman Is Just Out, is part memoir and part manifesto dedicated to the women who've made her life possible. Isabel Allende is 78 now. And The Soul of a Woman is largely a call to arms to attend to the unfinished business of feminism. I asked her how she became a feminist in the kind of society that Chile was, as she describes it, full of machismo. How did she find her feminist voice?
Oh, it took a long time. What I had was the feminist anger at the beginning. And that started very early on when I was living in my grandfather's house with my grandfather and my uncles and my mother, who had become a single mother because my father abandoned her with three babies in diapers. And she found herself like a charity case living in my grandfather's house. And I saw her so vulnerable and poor because she had no resources of any kind. She only had what my grandfather would give her, and that would be a roof over her head, schooling for the kids, I suppose, and things like that. But my mother never had any money for herself and no freedom, because at the time she had to take care of her reputation. A woman that had separated from the husband in that social class was totally unacceptable. I mean, you had to put up with all kinds of violence and whatever from a husband, but never separate, because that would be a public scandal, to the point that I was kicked out of the nuns, of the Ursuline nuns, because of my mother's situation.
Expelled at six?
They said it was because I was very rebellious, but I'm sure it was not the case. I was six.
At 6 years old, expulsion at 6 years old is fairly advanced.
Rather advanced, yes.
Did you ever try to track down your father? Were you ever interested in finding him?
No, because the condition, I mean, the only way that you could undo a marriage in Chile where there was no divorce until 2004 was by annulling the annulment of the marriage. And that would require some legal trick. But both parts had to consent. And so for my father to consent, his condition was that he would never have to take care of his children. And he took that to the point of never seeing us again, or having absolutely no interest in ever meeting us. He never really met his youngest child because Juan was born after he had left. So why would I be interested in him if he was not interested in me?
Was that a reason why, as you describe yourself, you were in a state of contained fury?
I don't think it was because of my father. I think it was because I saw my mother so vulnerable and so fragile in many ways. And I didn't want to be like her in that sense. I adored her. But I didn't want to be as dependent and vulnerable as she was. One of the things that I heard my grandfather say often, and my grandfather was a great guy, don't get me wrong. He would say, "He who pays the bills gives the orders." And to me, that was clear from very early on in my childhood that I had to support myself if I wanted to have any kind of independence. And that was what my mother couldn't do for herself. Well, she was stuck with three kids and no skills to work. So I think that that's where all the rebelliousness began for me, seeing my mom.
Yeah, and yet you got married at 20, which seems remarkably young. What were the...
No, today, not then. Then, if you had not lured a husband by age 25, you were a spinster.
Were you in the business of luring a husband?
I suppose I was, because I got one.
Mm-hmm. And he and you fled Chile after the coup. Did you ever think about going back to Chile to live? I mean, there were certain, you know, landmarks, Pinochet's death, for example.
That was much, much later.
Yes, of course.
We never thought that the dictatorship would last so long. But I was clear that I was not going to go back to a country that was still in the same condition as it was when I left. I had left for very clear reasons, and those reasons were still there. So by 1989, when the country called for a plebiscite and eventually the dictatorship lost the plebiscite and Pinochet had to step down, I could have gone back. And I did go back to vote and to visit. But I was married with an American by then and living in California. And I was trying to become a citizen in California because I wanted to sponsor my children to come here. So it was not the time to go back to live in Chile. And that was many, many years ago, and I've never gone back to live, although I visit all the time.
I was one of the people that you admire as former Chilean President Michelle Bachelet. And and I was just thinking how extraordinary it is that she went back to Chile after her father essentially was killed by the regime. She and her mother were tortured and imprisoned. She fled and then returned in 1979. And that was an extraordinary act of bravery or recklessness, I suppose.
No, bravery. Bravery and a sense of mission, I think, because she got rapidly involved in politics. And she was in the resistance and working against the dictatorship. So she's an extraordinary human being.
Chile made a transition to democracy in 1990. Did you think that that would be more successful than it has proven to have been?
Well, it's a complicated story. Chile was successful as a democracy for a long time after the dictatorship. It was very difficult. The transition was very difficult because the military were still there and Pinochet was still the chief of the armed forces and had a lot of power. He was a senator for life. And he had a following, a large following. So for the democratic governments that came after the dictatorship, it was important to keep the military calm, don't provoke anything, and go slowly. So we had inherited a constitution that Pinochet imposed on the country in 1981. And the constitution was fixed somehow several times by different democratic governments, but essentially it remained the same as the one that had created the dictatorship, especially in the economic sense. It was an extreme neoliberal constitution that guaranteed everything for capital and very little for labor, and privatized everything also. So even the water that you drink in Chile belongs to somebody. Eventually, that created incredible disparity in income, resources, opportunities, and anger and violence. And all that exploded in October 2019. And the country, they raised the fee in the subway. And some kids protested there. And in 24 hours, there was 1 million people in the streets protesting about everything. Mostly inequality, lack of opportunities, low salaries, and a system that created extreme wealth in the hands of very few, while the rest was struggling, and in many cases, people were hungry.
A new constitution in Chile, of course, is on the way. Do you think that'll make any difference?
Depends. The new constitution is an optimistic idea of creating a a map for the future in which everybody will be included. All the voices will be heard, and the constitution will be drafted by the people, not by the authorities. However, one thing is to draft the constitution and something very different to implement it. In Chile, what has happened in the last couple of years is that the institutions have lost all prestige. Nobody believes in anything. The popularity of the president could not be lower. In some moments, it has been less than 10%. Everybody hates the Congress. Nobody believes in the judiciary system. Not even the church stands by its feet, because you wouldn't leave a child alone with a priest in Chile today, after all the scandals with pedophiles that we have had. So everything has sort of, it's broken. And I think it's a great opportunity to create something new and way better, a new normalcy. And maybe this is something that is going to start to happen in many other places, because the feelings that we had in Chile, the anger, the frustration, was not only Chilean. I mean, it's all over Latin America. It's all in many places in the world. The young people don't find themselves represented by any of the institutions, especially the political institutions.
I did not realize, I mean, we're talking about a country, Chile, of course, who at the same time as going through rapid modernization was still extraordinarily archaic in some of its laws. I didn't realize that it had a total abortion ban until 2017. That includes, as a result of rape, endangering the mother's life, non-viable fetus, total ban. And you were involved in helping, when you were very young, helping an even younger woman to get an illegal abortion in Chile, weren't you?
Yes. And that, in a way, marked my life and my beliefs. So I have been a fierce defendant of women's right to choose, having control of your own fertility. I think it's a human rights thing. If you don't control your body and your own fertility, then you don't control anything in your life.
You must feel as if the clock is, at least for the last 4 years, been turned backwards in the United States. I mean, you talk about loss of faith in institutions and authorities, freedom of choice. All those things seem to be more jeopardized now than they were earlier.
In the United States?
Yes.
The 4 years of Trump were, in my opinion, lethal, very toxic. And the fact that 80 million people voted for him in spite of those 4 years, it gives me little hope for the future, because those people aren't going anywhere. They're still there. And they will change one conspiracy theory for another one. So this is a country divided and wounded. Biden has talked a lot about unity and trying to reconcile the country. Let's hope that he will be able to do it.
That doesn't sound as if you're terribly optimistic.
No, but I am hopeful. Because I've seen so much in my life, I know that change doesn't come quickly. Sometimes it appears to something that something happens and everything changes, but then it takes years for things to get established and really be rooted in reality. So I don't know what to think about the United States. It's been such a hard time for people like myself who hated Trump, and the lies, the brutality, the bullying, the lack of decency in every sense was appalling. And so we are trying to mend that. Let's see if that's possible.
One of the ways that you've tried to make a real difference is with your foundation, which you set up after your daughter Paula's death at the age of 29. And also after an experience in India you describe. You've described it before, you describe it again in this book, and it was an extraordinarily poignant experience. Could you describe it again for me?
After my daughter died, I was in a sort of void. I couldn't write. I couldn't do anything. And my husband then, Willie, and a friend, decided that I needed to get out of my comfort zone. And they organized a trip to India. I had never been in India. And we, among other things, we rented a car and went to rural Rajasthan with a driver. We were in the middle of nowhere. It was very hot. And the engine of the car was hot, and they stopped. And the driver stopped to cool it with some water or something. And there was a tree not far away where a group of women were there. But there was no village, no well, nothing around that would justify the presence of those women there. So my friend and I walked to see what was that about. And they were very, very poor, some, let's say, six women with some very young children. And we had bought some bracelets in the market, and so they were touching our hair. And, you know, touching becomes the language when you don't share a language. And so we gave them the bracelets, and they were very happy. And then the driver honked, and it was time to get back in the car. And when we were leaving, one of the women gave me a little parcel of rags. And I thought she was trying to give me something back for the bracelets. And I said, no, it's not necessary. I tried to give it back. But she insisted. So I sort of separated the rags, and inside was a newborn baby. The baby, I don't think, was a day old. The umbilical cord was fresh, raw, and tiny, tiny and dark. And so I kissed the baby, blessed the baby, and tried to give it back, but she wouldn't take it. And then the driver came running, this big man with a turban, and took the baby and gave it to, I don't know if it was the mother or somebody else, gave the baby to somebody and pushed me back to the car. And when we had already left, like a minute or two later, I reacted and I said, "Why would that woman want to give me the baby?" And the driver said, It was a girl. Who wants a girl? And I think that about that girl all the time. I she haunts me. I don't know if she would be alive today. Maybe not. And I couldn't do anything for her. But I knew what I was going to do when I returned home. And I created a foundation whose mission is to help women like that mother and girls like that baby.
How does it work? What do you do?
We don't invent anything. We try to finance or help finance programs, projects that work in the field. If you take a look at my website, you'll see how more than 100 programs that we support. And they have to do with empowering women, with women's reproductive rights, protection against violence, education, or giving them a skill so that they can support themselves. And now we work a lot with immigrants and refugees because Trump created a real human crisis, humanitarian crisis in the border by closing the border for asylum seekers and refugees. So they are on the other side of the wall in really refugee camps. And the most vulnerable, as always, are the women and the girls.
And so what does the foundation do for them?
We support, for example, an organization called KIND, which means Kids in Need of Defense. It's 40,000 lawyers in the country who work pro bono to represent those kids in court. Because you can have a three-year-old Guatemalan child that has been separated from the mother, that doesn't know where he is or who he is, and has to stand in court in front of a judge in English to defend his case because he will not have a lawyer if there wouldn't be a pro bono person who is willing to represent him. We also support other organizations that fight for the rights of asylum seekers, or provide the minimal necessities in the camps, so like water, like latrines, that kind of stuff.
I'm talking to author and social activist Isabel Allende. You were a journalist for many, many years, did not write until you were nearly 40 fiction. What took you to fiction?
Well, I was living in exile and I couldn't work as a journalist for many, many years.
You were in where? You went to Venezuela first?
Yeah, first to Venezuela. And I could not find a job as a journalist. So I worked for years administering a school, which is not the kind of stuff that I'm good at. I'm really bad at that. But I did it for years. And at one point in 1981, by then I was 39 years old. I felt very frustrated. My marriage wasn't going anywhere. My children were ready to abandon the nest. And I felt that my life was done, that it was so flat, so boring. Everything was just gray. And then I got a phone call that my grandfather was dying in Chile, but I couldn't go back to bid him farewell. And I started a letter. I had written to him many letters during those years. And I started another letter to tell him that he could go in peace, because I remembered everything he had ever told me. He was a great storyteller. And I remember everything about the family. It wouldn't be lost with me. And to prove that, in a way, I started writing the story of my great aunt Rosa, who was my grandfather's first fiancée. And rapidly, as I was writing, I think in a matter of a couple of days, I realized that this was not a letter. This was something else. And I didn't know what it was. If it was a kind of chronicle, a memoir, what was it? But I didn't ask myself many questions because I knew nothing about the book industry. I had never read a book review in my life, like most normal people never do. And I just wrote and wrote and wrote at night because I worked during the day and on the weekends. By the end of the year, I had 560 pages in the kitchen counter. And that was my first novel.
Was it accepted immediately by the publisher?
No, it was rejected everywhere. But then somebody told me that no one would read it. I was a new writer. It was too long. First novel. So they said that I needed an agent. And they gave me the number or the address of an agent in Spain, Carmen Balcells. And I sent her the manuscript by mail. And she called me back to Venezuela and said, I'm going to try to have this book published. I think it's a very good book, but everybody can write a good book, a first good book. The writer is proven on the second book and the ones that follow. So don't quit your day job. And I didn't quit my day job. But I started immediately writing another book. And so that's how it got started. She published the book in September in Spain. And in October was the Frankfurt Book Fair that at the time was the biggest in Europe. And everybody bought the book. It became the hit of the Frankfurt Fair. And I got contracts for Germany, Italy, Portugal, everywhere. But I was living in Venezuela, and all this was happening in Barcelona, really, in my agent's office. So I wasn't aware of the success of the House of the Spirits until I started getting the first checks. And that was like by the end of the year, or the next year.
It was magical realism, and magical realism had been made famous, I suppose, by you know, male writers with whom we're all familiar. Why did you choose to write in that style? Or was it not a choice? It just was.
I wasn't aware that I was writing in a particular style.
Mm-hmm.
I was just telling a story. And I don't know. That's a strange question because I never thought that I had chosen a particular style. People have talked about the structure of the House of the Spirits. What structure? I just sat down and wrote. And I remember that a critic said that it had a cyclic, circular structure. I had never heard anything like that. I thought that cyclic was menstruation and structure was the buildings. So I pretended that I understood what he was saying, but I didn't really.
And book after book followed, including, I was thinking about the book that you wrote about the death of your daughter when you described how you wrote that first book, The House of the Spirits, because that also began as a way to keep memory alive, didn't it?
Yeah. So I have been writing letters all my life to my mother, mostly. I was separated from my mother since age 16, more or less. And we started writing to each other. At the time, she was living in Turkey, and the letters would last, would take at least 2 months sometimes to get from one place to the other. So it was not as if we were corresponding in a sort of conversation. It was an ongoing monologue. And we kept the habit always, to the point that my son recently decided that we had to digitalize the letters because some of the old ones were being destroyed by time and humidity and whatever. And he calculated that we have 24,000 letters. My letters and my mother's letters in boxes for decades. And so the habit of writing letters is so ingrained in me that I don't even think. I sit down and just, I can pour out a letter. And I would write to my, when Paula fell sick in Madrid, I was just pacing the corridors of the hospital where she was in intensive care. And I was allowed to visit only for 5 minutes a day, but they wouldn't tell you which 5 minutes at what time that would be. So I just spent the day in the hospital, and I wrote letters to her, telling her who she was, where she came from, who was her family, her country, what had happened to her. Because I had been told that people who are in a coma, when they wake up, they don't remember lots of things. And so that was a sort of exercise in writing for me, telling Paula all that in letters. I used all those letters, plus the letters I wrote to my mother that year, to Chile, to write the memoir, Paula.
Did you, I mean, you obviously did believe she would recover, or?
Of course.
You did?
Of course, because the doctors kept saying that she would recover. They never admitted that they had neglected her in intensive care and she had severe brain damage, which had nothing to do with her condition. We found out that much later. So I was waiting, and I waited for 5 months until finally they admitted that she was never going to wake up. So at that point, I decided to bring her to my home in California where I could take care of her. And I did that.
How did you deal with your anger about the hospital that had let you and her down so badly?
You know what? Anger was useless. I was so worried about Paula, I had no time to think about the anger. And then when I could have thought about anger, I realized that nobody did anything on purpose. It was a huge hospital, the Hospital Clínico de Madrid. And it was on strike. The staff was overworked, underpaid, on strike. The only person I could blame was the porphyria specialist that totally experimented with my daughter. He is to blame, but the rest of the people, no. There were shortages of electricity, and Paula was on a respirator. So if there's no electricity, the respirator doesn't work, and she doesn't get oxygen. And, of course, then the result is severe brain damage.
And she could have recovered from the liver disorder had that not happened?
Yes, we have other cases of porphyria in the family, and no one has died of it. Mm. It's a very serious condition, but not necessarily fatal.
Yeah, I mean, many people say they don't know how you got over that, but obviously you did, and you have, but you never lose the grief, right?
But I don't want to lose the grief.
No.
The grief is something soft, like a soft animal that is always with me. And sometimes I have flashes of real pain in which I feel like being on my knees crying. But most of the time, I'm fine. And if I'm sad, it's because I loved her so much. If I remember her so much, it's because she gave me so much in the 28 years that we shared. So I don't want to lose that. None of it.
I'm talking to Isabel Allende. Let me just talk about your latest novel for a moment. It's a novel along Petal of the Sea, which I think is a line that Pablo Neruda used to describe Chile. And it features Pablo Neruda and a ship, a rescue ship that he organized in 1939, saving refugees from the Spanish Civil War. And this is a true story that you've woven into a novel. You met Pablo Neruda, didn't you?
Yeah, a couple of times. But the story for me came to life in Venezuela when I was living in exile. And one of the passengers of that ship, of the Winnipeg, was in his second exile. He had had to leave Chile as he had left Spain before, escaping from similar circumstances. And he told me the story of how he got to Chile and what had happened in the Winnipeg and all that. And I carried the story with me for almost 40 years until I thought it was time to tell it, because the theme of refugees was in the air.
And Pablo Neruda never had the pleasure of reading it, of course, because...
Of course not. He died in 1973.
He died long ago. In fact, you must have met him not long before his death.
Yeah, not long before his death, he invited me to his house in Isla Negra. It's a beach resort that in winter is practically empty, where he had his house. The house still stands there, and it's a museum today. And so he invited me, and I thought that he wanted me to interview him, because at the time I was a journalist. So I got there and we had a lovely lunch. And at some point I said, okay, Don Paulo, I'm ready for the interview because I have to get back home. It was 2 hours and a half to get back. And he said, what interview? I don't want you to interview me. You are the worst journalist in this country, my dear. You put yourself in the middle of everything. You cannot be objective. And I am sure that if you don't have a story, you make it up. Why don't you switch to literature, where all these effects are virtues?
And did you appreciate that advice?
No, I didn't pay any attention to it. But he said it kindly. He wasn't trying to insult me.
Was he nice?
Sometimes, with some people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a public figure from very early on. He was a Nobel Prize, known all over the world, translated to every language. So he had a sense of his own value. And that can translate into arrogance sometimes. But he was he enjoyed life. He was a bon vivant. And he was a good friend of his friends. He loved to eat and sing and collect all kinds of junk that today are called art. But at the time it was junk.
Here in New Zealand, we are said to have something called a tall poppy syndrome. Which means, we don't like people being too successful. We don't like people getting too big for their boots. You've described something very similar in Chile. What's the word for it?
Chaqueteo. In Chile, when anybody goes a little bit above the media, that person is pulled down by the lapels of the jacket. So we call it chaqueteo, the jacket. You pull the jacket. And it's so Chilean that if it doesn't happen to you, it's because you are nobody.
Did it happen to Neruda?
Neruda had many enemies, and mostly political enemies because he was a communist. And but also envy, because he was such an extraordinarily well-known person in a country where we think that if somebody is too famous, that person is taking the oxygen from everybody else. So nobody else has a chance because that person has all the chances, which is a stupid way of looking at it. But you know what? I have talked about this with other writers, and many have told me that in their countries, small countries mostly, it's the same. I have for example, an Irish friend who says, oh, in Ireland it's exactly the same. So I suppose that in New Zealand it's the same.
Yes.
What's the name for you? How do you call it?
We call it the tall poppy syndrome. Yeah, tall poppies.
That's more poetic. More poetic.
But you must have encountered that yourself, not only a very successful writer, but also a woman.
Yeah, of course, especially in Chile. But you know what? At a certain point, after a lot happened, and many books, I got the highest award for literature in Chile, which is the National Award for Literature. And that gave me finally some weight. And now it's not as easy to pull me down there, thanks to that award.
Chile's National Prize for Literature. Was that the award, and you've won many awards, is that the award that's meant most to you?
Probably it's very important. Just for me, the Medal of Freedom in the United States is very important because it's the highest honor that a civilian can get in this country, which is not usually bestowed on immigrants. That was important, and national awards that I have had for my writing in the United States. But you know what? The real award is the readers, the readership, the fact that millions of people are reading me, and I get such fantastic feedback. I get so much correspondence and people, so many people in FaceTime and in Instagram. So that's the reward, the greatest reward.
You married again for the third time at the age
Probably it will not be the last one.
Whoa. How are things going with Roger?
You know, everything is fine with Roger, but I keep telling him, you are my third husband, but don't relax, because you might not be the last one.
I became a little worried about your marriage, because you've said, thanks to COVID lockdown, you've written in this latest book, I am afraid that if this crisis goes on much longer, we will run out of the patience, kindness and discipline to put up with each other. Forced and close coexistence can be very irritating. How's it going now?
Yeah. Yes, you know what, Kim? We live in a very small house. When I divorced Willie, my second husband, I decided that I was too old to even think about another partner. So I sold everything, furniture, everything, and bought a very small house with one bedroom where I could live in peace with my dog. But then Willie died, and I inherited a second dog. And then Roger came to my life. So now we all live in this small place. I'm talking to you in the attic where I write. But amazingly, this extended, forced honeymoon has not killed the love. He's a very patient and kind man, I have to say.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
And, yeah.
And on January the 8th, you began writing what book?
This year, I had already finished another novel that I wrote last year. I finished it in December. And I started another book, which I don't know where it's going, but I started something. I always start something on January 8th.
Why?
Superstition and discipline. Discipline because my life is complicated, and if I don't set aside the time, the silence, the solitude to write, I wouldn't be able to do it.
And the January the 8th superstition, how did that emerge?
Because it was the first book. The phone call from my grandfather was on a January 8th, 1981. And then I started the second book on the same date because I was working in a school and January was still a holiday, so I wasn't working at that point. But also out of superstition, because I thought, well, if my first book is doing okay, at least somebody's reading it, I will start the next one on the same date. And then I did the same thing with the third book. And now I don't dare change it because it will be a flop.
No, and it's obviously worked so far.
Yeah, it works. Yeah.
You have what you describe as an intimate spiritual practice circle called the Sisters of Perpetual Disorder. Are you able to meet in these times?
We meet on Zoom.
Yes.
Regularly. And we keep in touch. via email all the time and on the phone. But we meet on Zoom, and we've discovered that it's very convenient because at our age, sometimes it's hard. One of us lives in the beach, and the drive is a very curvy, dark, dangerous road. And so in winter, it's dark by the time we finish the meeting. Dangerous for her. Now that we meet on Zoom, we can talk forever and it's fine.
And can you tell me what the spiritual practice is?
Well, we meditate. We say that we pray. That means we put our intentions in trying to help people who are in need, people who are sick, or who ask us to pray for them. And regularly, each one at home does some meditation also. And when we meet, we check to see where we are in life, what has happened during the week. And then we usually have a question that we have pondered and we can talk about. Sometimes it's a poem. But, for example, during the pandemic, there has been a lot about illness and death and vulnerability and all that. During the 4 years of Trump, we tried to avoid talking only politics, but it would always come up, you know.
And you have described this as the era of emboldened grandmothers. Are you all emboldened grandmothers?
We are. We are. We are because we are healthy. We are have accumulated experience. We are strong. We are involved in the world. We all want to make a difference. So two of them are writers. One of them is a lawyer who works with a kind of law that I don't remember the name exactly, but instead of using law for conflict, use it to solve conflict. So, for example, a couple...
Conflict resolution.
Exactly. Right. A couple that is divorcing, instead of getting each one a lawyer, and the lawyer gets most of the money and everybody ends up killing each other, they choose two lawyers that belong to this organization. And these two lawyers try to avoid conflict, to resolve the situation as fast as possible for a minimal wage. So that's beautiful.
Isabel Allende. And the book we were talking about in large part is called The Soul of a Woman.